Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks again for joining the Socialist Insight. Today we have a very special guest on our program today. His name is Evel Justin. And he has been working with the Alexander Mendoza campaign, putting together things to help promote not only the party, but also to promote, as I mentioned, the Alexander Mendoza campaign here in 2012. I'm Stuart Alexander, and I am the presidential candidate for the Socialist Party USA, and Alex Mendoza, he is the vice presidential nominee. Evel, thank you very much for joining the program.
No problem. It's good to be here. It's an honor.
Evel, what I would like for you to do is take probably about a minute or so and just share with our listeners today who you are and when you became a member and a part of the Socialist Party USA and also with the socialist movement. Could you take a minute for that, please?
Sure. Well, my name is Justin Jones. I'm basically a 19-year-old political activist from the state of Alabama. I've been a member of the Socialist Party USA since December of 2011. Before that, I had been involved in political activism since I was probably about 14 years old, and that's kind of unusual for someone that young. But it's just something I had always been that I had caught an interest in, and I was actually a socialist for a really long time and just didn't even realize it. But eventually, I became familiar with the platform of the Socialist Party USA and just on socialism in general, what it really was, once I started to investigate and read. Actually was a socialist.
Now, at times you've gone over with the media, Facebook in particular, and you've referred to yourself as Evel and Justin. Could you explain how you have come with the various variations of your name over a period of time? Because I still call you Evel.
Yeah, well, it was supposed to be Evel Justin. I just had a unique way of spelling it, and I'll tell you where that came from. I still have a YouTube channel where I make the videos and such, and I, you know, make those political ads promoting the Alexander Mendoza campaign. And the name really just came from I was about 15. And I was wanting to make political videos or just any kind of videos, really, and so I couldn't come up with a good name. And I just thought, well, Justin Jones is a little bit too boring. So I came up with something goofy and spiced it up a little bit, and it just wound up sticking after all these years, and people have referred to me as Evel Justin. And so they still call me that to this day. I've had that other Facebook account I had actually. But I'm sticking with the one I have now under Justin Jones. So for anybody out there, if you want to call me Justin, Evel Justin, Evel, I don't care. I know who you're talking to.
Well, I still call you Evel, but on the show today, so people know who I'm talking to, I'll just say Justin Jones.
There you go.
Justin, you have been very inspiring in your work for the Socialist Party USA and also in particular this campaign. What was it about this campaign, the Alexander Mendoza 2012 presidential campaign, what drew you to support this campaign? I might mention that Justin has been one of the strongest supporters of this campaign here in 2012, and we have to give him a lot of credit for whatever number of votes we get, have to give him a lot of the credit for that. But what drew you to the campaign in the first place, Justin?
Well, I've become disillusioned with the Obama administration and the Democratic Party. Yes, those certain views had been passed on to me, and so by the time I became a political activist, I was doing a lot of work, actually, for the Democratic Party, but then I found that my views and my values weren't being represented.
Hello?
Absolutely led me. Can you hear me?
Justin, you've been breaking up some.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's coming in and out. I'm not certain if it's my line or yours, though, but it's going in and out.
It's probably mine. I've been having difficulty with my phone.
Okay, we can hear you well now.
Okay, it's going to be my phone, so if I cut out, you're just going to have to tell me to repeat something.
Okay.
Anyway,
okay.
Sorry, we're going to have technical difficulties. Very sorry. But anyways, I had become disillusioned with the Democratic Party. I saw what they represented. And when I began to learn about socialism, I really didn't see any socialist parties that were really represented in the United States very well. And then I stumbled upon the Socialist Party USA. And
back to
ever since.
Yeah, I think Justin's phone is going in and out, and I'm not certain if he has a good connection. Are you there, Ruth Ann?
I'm here. Yeah, he's in and out. I don't know if it'd be better if he went outside the house or what. It might be too cold to do that. I don't know.
Yeah, Justin has been a strong benefit to the campaign over the past 7 months, 6 to 7 months. He has put together many of the videos that we presently use for the campaign. In addition to that, he has been very active on the social media, sharing various links and information. And over the time that the campaign has gone, I would say especially in the last 6 months, he has helped us to reach hundreds of thousands of people across the nation. Some of the things that I'm, as Justin had mentioned, he's only 19 years old, and we're going to be talking about some of the difficulties that many young people are encountering as far as for employment, housing, employment, education, and these are situations and issues that young people are being faced with across the nation. It seemed like his phone is, he's having some difficulties with his phone line.
Stuart?
But, are you
back
there, Justin?
Okay. I'm here, but it's breaking up. It's been doing this a lot lately. Can I call you back from a different phone in just a moment?
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just call back in, okay?
I apologize. Okay.
Oh, that's quite all right. Now, I might mention, Justin, he is right there in Alabama. There's a lot of despair and hardship that many working people, even young people, are experiencing right there in that part of the country. We can see it right here in California as well, Ruth Ann, is that many young people, they're having difficulties, especially young people that are in college and also high school. They're having difficulties trying to find part-time work or after-school jobs. Very unlike the situation I had when I was 16 and 17 years old going to high school and college.
Yeah.
There were plenty of jobs. If I left one job, it only just required me having enough time to go and apply at another location, and there were jobs working in local stores, local businesses. Jobs were abundance, were in abundance. But it's not like that today. And this is some of the things that we will be discussing with Justin today. Ruth Ann, what is it like with many of the youth there in that state when it comes to education in Illinois, where you're at?
They owe a lot of money, let's put it that way. And it's some people aren't going to college because they can't the idea that they're going to be in debt till they're 50 paying off college loans is more than they can handle. And so we're losing a lot of smart, intelligent people because of this.
Right.
And it's very sad.
And one of the things which you had mentioned in regards to many of the people that will be stuck with debt for decades, that debt, you can't put that, you can't discharge that debt. In other words, through bankruptcy, you can't walk away from it. This is debt, as you mentioned, that will stay with many of the young people today well into their years of when they go into their 40s and even their 50s. It's a debt that is just for education. And we with the Socialist Party USA and also as socialists, we believe that education should be free. I was just on 103.7 The Beat in Detroit, Michigan, just an hour and a half ago. And that was the same thing I was discussing on that program. And here you have the same situation there in Michigan. You have tens of thousands of students cannot find after-school work. In addition to that, you have students that have gone to college. They're strapped with debt. But you can go state after state after state, and that's the situation that we have with our young people. So,
well, and it's not just the young people, Stuart, because some of these...
No, it's not just young people.
Now, they're living with their families instead of living in the dorms or off campus, and their parents can't find work either.
Exactly.
You know, so, I mean, that's really... it's rough on families. Justin's back now.
And one of the things I'll mention, Ruth Ann, that you mentioned just a second ago, how many of these young people, how they're still living with their families under Obamacare, a lot of people may not realize it, is that there's a mandate under Obamacare that the parents in that household, if they have any children or any children that are under 25 years or younger, they're responsible for their health care costs until they turn until they're over 25 years old. They're responsible for their health care. So basically what this has done, it has given protection to the insurance industry, the health insurance industries. Are you back, Justin?
Yes, I'm back.
Yes.
Okay, you have a better phone now, huh?
I do. I had to use someone else's.
Justin, let me ask you, how is socialism, we're going to get back to education in a few minutes, but I just want to ask you, how do you see where socialism is relevant in today's society, especially from a youth perspective?
No, well, it's relevant in all kinds of ways, just simply because there's such hard times out there. I mean, people, especially young people, are struggling to even go to school. I mean, you've hit on the point before about education, and it's hard for people to get loans and to pay those back. I mean, people will spend 20, 30 years trying to pay back a student loan they had just to get an education when it should be free. And under
right.
socialism, they wouldn't have any of those problems. Many young people wouldn't face any of the terrible things they face today if we had a completely different economic and political system, and we just don't. So it's very relevant.
Well, where have you seen the flaws with capitalism in that regards? Because obviously when we're talking about private schools, privatizing universities, obviously is done where private corporations are able to make profits. They borrow money from banks. But where we have gone wrong in a capitalist society when it comes to education?
No, well, obviously we're putting way too much emphasis on profit in education, just like we do, for example, in healthcare. I mean, you can't have a successful healthcare system with a profit motive involved, and you certainly can't do it with education. Education should be about educating young people and not just training them to be a you know, like education today basically trains kids to be an obedient worker. It doesn't train them to be a thinker. It doesn't train them to live. It just trains them to do a job or to show up. That's the whole thing about compulsory education. It trains you to become a compulsory worker. And so the capitalist for-profit system has really wrecked education, amongst many other things, and that's why it's so relevant to understand why we need a new economic system.
Talking about economics, and what part of Alabama do you live in, Justin?
I live in a really small town called Alexandria. It's in northeast Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, if you know where Birmingham, Alabama is, it's probably about 2 hours away.
And when you think about Alabama, obviously, I mean, I can think about Alabama when I was young and what we used to see on television, and a couple of times in the last 35 years I've actually driven through the state. But what is the economic climate there in Alabama with jobs, and in particular jobs for young people there in that state?
Well, just like with any southern, you know, southern state that traditionally votes for Republicans, I would say, we're some of the poorest states. I mean, those policies don't work for anyone except the super wealthy. And so, obviously, we have a lot of unemployment. The education system is beyond broken. People here in the state are generally, the schools are underfunded, and therefore the people are less educated than someone, say, in Massachusetts. We still have a lot of religious influence on things like that. But as far as the economy goes, yes, very, very dire, very tough situations for families here because we are one of the poorest states in the union.
What kind of work have you done yourself, Justin?
Oh, I haven't. I'm not going to kill myself yet. No.
Have you ever looked for any after-school work when you were in high school or anything like that?
Yes, I did, and I didn't get it. I applied, I think, for three different jobs, and I got an interview with one, and they never said anything back to me. And after that, I began to move on to college, and I thought, well, before I become a wage slave, I think I'm going to go ahead and get an education.
And what type of work do your parents, do they do?
My father actually, he worked as a produce manager for years. He worked at a few grocery stores, made pretty decent money as a produce manager, and then he fell off of a truck one day, broke his leg, and he doesn't have a knee anymore. And so he's on disability. My mother, she used to work at the Homeland Security branch that was pretty close to here. It was at a sort of a military fort. She used to work there and make pretty good money. But I don't know. I don't live with my mother. I haven't heard from her in a while, so I don't even know if she's still there, if she's out of work. I actually live with my father and my grandfather, which my grandfather's retired. He worked at a cotton mill for 35 years, and my dad is disabled.
Well, and I'm sorry to hear, you know, the hardships that your family that you're going through. When we talk about the jobs like your dad, he worked as a produce manager. By the way, I actually worked as an assistant produce manager years ago when I worked for Safeway Stores. And years ago, I ended up leaving that company as an assistant manager. But I did work as a clerk and worked my way up from that position. But many of those jobs we find today are just, especially whether it's a courtesy clerk or clerks working part-time, they're low-paid jobs. And in today's society, we see that it requires a lot of skill. But you and also the Socialist Party and socialists worldwide, we believe that we need to have a living wage. Why do you see yourself that it's important that people have a livable wage?
Well, because workers deserve to keep all the fruits of their labor. They should not be robbed by a capitalist. It's just that simple. The workers should run the workplaces. They shouldn't be paid a wage for selling their labor to some capitalist. They should be able to keep every bit of it. And, of course, if you work for a living, you should be able to live on it. You shouldn't have to work two or three jobs just to get by and still have to get on food stamps or something. And that's a very real situation that's happening today. I mean, we see all these people that are getting on the food stamp rolls and that are getting on welfare. Well, those aren't people who don't work. They do work. They just aren't getting paid. They can't get by on what they're being paid. So it's very, very important that we have something such as a living wage.
And what is the minimum wage there in Alabama?
$7.25.
$7.25.
Yep.
And that's the federal minimum wage right there.
Right.
And you probably would agree with me, a person, even if they work 40 hours a week, cannot live on they cannot have a household, maintain a household on $7.25 a week. And it's probably the same way there in Alabama, am I correct?
Correct. It's very hard for working people to get by. And what most people don't understand is that if we weren't paying for the rich to, you know, sit back and own capital and force us to build yachts for them, the average work week would probably be about 2 hours a day of labor. And that's the truth. The reason we're working and producing so much is because the capitalists own everything and we are being forced to sell our labor to produce more capital for them.
Exactly. And then there would be more workers to be able to share that labor, so we would have more free time for ourselves to enjoy the fruits of our labor.
Exactly.
Justin, you place a lot of information there on the various social medias about the Democrats and the Republicans. When you look at those two parties, do you see any difference between the Democrats and Republicans? Because some people say voting for the lesser of two evils. Well, personally, I don't see any difference. But what is your opinion? Is between those two parties, is there a lesser of the two evils?
Lesser evil is an oxymoron. You don't have lesser of that. There's either something's evil or it's good, period. The fact is, the only differences between the Democrats and Republicans is tactical differences within the ruling elite that own those parties. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's stuff such
right.
as...
Right, own those parties.
Right, right. They are completely
right.
owned. Owned, bought,
mm-hmm.
and paid for by people that have a very different class interest than somebody like you, I, or Ruth Ann. The truth is, the only differences between those parties are tactical differences, such as, well, are we going to bomb Iran or are we going to bomb Syria? The fact remains,
mm-hmm.
we're bombing somebody. We're going to start another war. That's already set in stone. Just who is it?
Right.
It's things such as that. Well, in the debate, there's no discussion about, hey, maybe war is a bad idea. Maybe we shouldn't do that anymore. Maybe we can't afford it. Maybe it's immoral to kill people for profit. So you don't hear any of that. So in the big picture, no difference. Small picture, very little tactical differences. But it's certainly not worth voting for one because there's some kind of lesser evil. I think that argument's bogus.
Now, say for instance, Obama was elected out of this election, which is coming up tomorrow. Do you think there will be any change in his agenda, or will we just see more of the same of what we've already gotten?
There's no reason to believe we wouldn't see more of the same. He's already, for example, he's already. Said during the debates that he'd be willing to adopt Mitt Romney's position on Social Security. I mean, he said, we agree there. Now, that's something that should scare, you know, that should scare anyone on the left, and to know that he agrees with someone like Mitt Romney who would want to privatize Social Security.
Right.
So he's already admitted in his own words that, yes, he's going to do more of the same. He's going to cut the social safety net. He's going to continue to reward the banks and the capitalists. He's not going to do anything for working people. I think he's made that crystal clear himself, so there's no deception here.
What is your opinion about the mounting debt that's taking place in this country? Right now we're at $16 trillion, and they're estimating within the next 5 years, and I believe it'll be sooner than 5 years, that we'll be over $22 trillion in debt. Is there a serious commitment, in your opinion, of either of these presidential candidates, the president or Mitt Romney, in addressing that massive debt that our future children will be faced with?
Absolutely not. There is no serious discussion about it whatsoever. They like to fearmonger with the debt so they can say, hey, we have all this debt, now we're going to attack Social Security and poor people, who obviously caused it, and I'm being sarcastic there. They don't ever talk
mm-hmm.
about the things that really run up the debt, which is these wars, which are first of all illegal, but secondly costly. I mean, we've been in Afghanistan for how many years now? Over 10? About 11 years?
We've been in Afghanistan over 10 years. Right,
right.
At 10 years.
Do you even realize how much money that is just on a daily basis? And that's what happens with capitalism in general. You get all of the debt and none of the benefits. It happens every single time. You need to ask a capitalist, if it really works so well, why are we always being stuck with the debt? Why is the debt being socialized and the profits being privatized?
And what you're mentioning in regards to that, it's already been estimated that those two wars, those theaters of war, as you mentioned also, they are illegal, that it will cost American taxpayers well over $4 trillion, and these are the real numbers that we're looking at. And even though we're out of, supposedly Barack Obama said, well, we're out of Iraq now, we still have a presence right there in Iraq, and the war, they're already estimating that they will be continuing this war there in Afghanistan. How your position, what do you think in regard? Because one of the things I'm bringing up war and the military is because it's their wars, but we get our young people, they go and fight the wars for them. So obviously this is an issue that young people should be part of the discussion. So when it comes to the military, we believe that it's a war there in Afghanistan that we need to end like yesterday. It shouldn't take place over another few months, 9 months, as Barack Obama had promised in 2008. He said we'll have all of our troops out within 9 months of me taking office. But we believe it should be, with the Socialist Party USA, that we need to have an immediate withdrawal. What is your position on that?
Well, first of all, it's bad enough to even think about what war really is. I mean, it's an insipid, vile, disgusting, horrifying event that should never happen, first of all. But secondly, to know that these wars are all based on lies makes it even worse. The lie about, oh, they have weapons. Well, that's not true. They're using that lie again that they used with Iraq. They're using it with Iran this time. Both parties, might I add. These wars are being waged for profit and to uphold the capitalist system. This is the other stage of capitalism called imperialism. When the economic structure starts to decline, they go over and take over oil resources from around other parts of the planet, let the American corporations take over those reserves, and the capitalists and the war profiteers get richer. But they don't ever go fight in these wars. Their kids don't fight in them. They let working-class people kill off other working-class people from around the planet, and they're all blinded by lies, religion, other things. And so I would certainly agree with the position of the Socialist Party USA.
Well, we're going to get into another area of the military-industrial complex, because obviously we're not utilizing a draft at this point. And they do have where you're required to register once you turn 18, where you become eligible in case of war for a draft. What is your position on a military draft and even having that on the table?
It can be chalked up to tyranny, authoritarian tyranny, to say, well, you're going to fight in this war, whether or not you agree with it, or you'll go to jail.
And that's the way it was in during the Vietnam War, that many people were going to jail, and at times they were leaving the country as a result of that war.
Right.
And as I mentioned myself, I am very opposed to a military draft, but as we continue these wars, one of two things happen. They either have a draft, or what they do is they contract individuals to go as mercenaries and also contractors to go into these war areas, which unfortunately becomes very expensive to the nation. I might mention that the cost of the defense spending in the U.S. amounts to approximately one half of our total budget. We have the military expenditures. The cost for maintaining a military in this country is right at $700 billion. And now we see President Barack Obama, he says that he's going to cutting the military spending in half, which is just another lie, because he hasn't laid out any plan on how he's going to do that. Justin, what I want you to do is take maybe another minute, just reintroduce yourself. Today we have Justin Jones. He has been working very actively with the Alexander Mendoza campaign here in 2012, and also he's a young socialist right there in Alabama, and has been helping to run with the socialist movement there in those local communities. But Justin, could you just take maybe a minute just to reintroduce yourself to our listeners today?
Yes, and I want to apologize for my phone breaking up earlier. We've been having trouble, and so I didn't mean to do that on the show. But anyways, Stuart did a great job of introducing me there. I am a 19-year-old political activist. I think when we left off, when I started breaking up, I was talking about how I came across the Socialist Party USA. And basically, my family has always voted mostly Democratic, and I had sort of adopted some of those views. And after, a few years, I became disillusioned with the Democratic Party. I realized that they supported capitalism, and I didn't really support that. And so they weren't aligned with my worldview anymore. And so I started to discover socialism and read up on it and figure out what it really was all about and to see through the propaganda and the lies around it, you know, how it's a dirty word. And once I did that, I realized that I didn't see any socialists in the mainstream media or anything else, and I didn't see any mainstream political party that represented it. And then I ran across the Socialist Party USA, and once I found out about Stuart Alexander clinching the nomination in October of 2011, from that point I pretty much said, well, I believe this is the guy I'm going to vote for.
Well, I appreciate it. And as I mentioned, Justin has been a very strong supporter for the Alexander Mendoza campaign. I have to give him a lot of credit for much of the momentum that this campaign has gotten over the last 6 to 8 months. He's utilized the very social medias, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Facebook, and he has made certain that we have maintained a very strong presence there for the party on the very social medias. And once again, Justin, I want to say thanks for that. Justin, I'm going to touch on a few items, one that you had mentioned in regards to Social Security, because this is something that you have expressed over the various social medias in regards to many of our aging people in this country and the attacks that the Republicans and also the Democrats are doing in privatizing Social Security. But where do you see Social Security going in this country under the Democrats or the Republicans?
Well, I think over the next few years, we'll see policies of at least cuts to Social Security. They have to find a way to hopefully pay for those tax cuts for the wealthy and for all those wars of aggression, and so they're going to attack seniors who live on Social Security. So they'll at least make cuts. Romney, if he's elected, may push for privatization like Bush did. But we'll see. But it won't go in a good direction. Social Security was originally, when FDR enacted it, basically it was a Band-Aid on capitalism. It allowed the bourgeois capitalists to keep their possessions and their property, but it gave a safety net to the workers. It didn't give them the means of production, but it gave them a system that would keep them out of poverty. So many say that it's a system that actually saved capitalism. The harshest critics of Social Security actually came from the left. It was signed into law because of the we used to have very strong socialist and communist parties at that time, and they pushed FDR into signing it. And so it's one of the few things right now that's keeping millions of seniors and working people from being out on the streets, including my family. It's something that we actually live off of, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that many of our seniors in this country are faced with is the problems, the situation with affordable housing. What is it like for many of the seniors there in Alabama?
It's probably tougher here than it is almost anywhere else in the country. But I will say one thing about affordable housing. When I was probably around 10 years old or so, when I was growing up, during the summer I would go stay with my father, who lived about 30 minutes from here before he moved in with us. He actually lived in sort of a public housing type thing, government housing. And you see people come and go out of those things, you know, frequently. And this was probably back around 2003 or so, 2004. The last time I went up there, which was just recently, earlier this year, there were more people in the public housing squares than I had ever seen. Apparently there were people that were just on a waiting list so an apartment would open up. This is the situation now because people obviously can't afford to invest in a home. So just to have a place to live, they're trying to rent apartments. So it's very tough here.
Another thing that when I think about the platform of the Socialist Party USA and also the Alexander Mendoza campaign, health care, obviously this is an issue. We have, I believe it's 26 different states that have filed a suit against Obamacare, and of course they want to go back to the old system where they make certain that the health insurance companies get all the profits, and Obamacare is making certain that it's done through the government, where it makes certain it protects their profits. Do you think there's any future? Where do you see any good for working people out of Obamacare?
I don't. I see a lot of good for private insurance companies. They're getting a subsidy. They're getting subsidized. They're getting guaranteed millions of new cash-paying customers because now it's going to be mandated. The law literally forces you to buy a health care plan from some insurance company like WellPoint. Something else that's not reported a lot, Obama actually appointed Liz Fowler, who is the CEO of WellPoint, to be one of the oversight managers for Obamacare. Now, how's that going to work out? Someone from private insurance is in charge of oversight. That's like putting someone from BP, a BP executive, in charge of oil rigs, regulating them. Okay, it's not going to work. So this was a sweetheart deal for private insurance. You're not going to fix health care in America until you take the profit motive out of health care and make it about the needs of working people. And Obamacare simply doesn't do that. It subsidizes the problem.
And what Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, the only thing that they're talking about is the need for private to protect the long term of Social Security and also to provide for the health care needs of the nation, is privatizing everything. In also, they have mentioned about creating like a voucher system. So ultimately, we can see the direction, as you mentioned earlier, Justin, is that they're looking at privatizing the whole system where various corporations will only benefit from that. Something I'll mention just recently, I changed my health care from one company to another health maintenance organization. But very interesting, before I was on my wife's health care program at her job, and before they would take me off, I had to give them proof that I had some type of health care with another organization. And I felt like that was an infringement on my rights, where I could not take myself off that plan and could not sever myself with the what they were taking out of my wife's pay until I could offer proof that I had health care coverage with another corporation. And that's one of the things that has come about as a result of Obamacare. So there's many flaws in the system, but I might mention what Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, what they're introducing, is very much similar. A lot of people may not realize also is that Obamacare, when you look at the framework for Obamacare, that came from Mitt Romney. So essentially, you have the same program, just where it's on a federal level as a result, federal level as opposed to on a state level. Another area I want to get into is you right there in one of the southern states. What are your ideas on immigration reform in this country? Where do you see that going in regards to much of the politics that we have seen over the last decade there and our southern borders, Justin?
Well, I think as far as the politics go, the hatred and the scapegoating of what they call illegal immigrants has really intensified. We saw that law in Arizona that Jan Brewer passed in 2010. I think it was called the Check Your Papers Law, where basically police can pull over anyone they suspect of being an illegal and ask them to produce paperwork. Things such as that. As far as immigration reform, President Obama, this is another one of his failures. He promised comprehensive immigration reform, and he hasn't touched it. The only thing he's presented to Congress was the DREAM Act, which was disgusting. It was, well, okay, you come sign up for military service, go fight in an illegal capitalist war, and if you don't get your head blown off, maybe you might get it to be a citizen. That's not a good plan. That's a disaster. We really need to rethink the way we think about borders in general. I mean, we've stated before when you and I have talked that we don't agree with borders at all. Borders
right, exactly.
are basically an invention of capitalism where they can exploit cheap labor. It's what the United States
exactly.
capitalists do to workers in Mexico. The labor is cheaper. They take the jobs there. They exploit those people, and it's even worse in the third world. I mean, it's pretty much slave labor there. There's, you know, up to 70% of people in the third world don't even have potable water, and those people are making money and profits for the capitalists here in the States. So as far as immigration goes, it is my position, as well as the position of the Socialist Party USA, that borders should be abolished, that workers of the world should unite, and then not some nationalist sense in one nation.
And many people don't understand borders, whether you're talking about the a river that's south of the that's on the U.S. southern border, or you're talking about an ocean, which is the Pacific Ocean. What the capitalists, their goal is the exploitation of cheap labor, whether it's through NAFTA or having people that can come over here and work for cheap labor, or utilizing that cheap labor in China. And that's what we see today. It's in China, Indonesia, it's in India, Korea. It's all about cheap labor. Another area I wanted to just mention that has come up from time to time in this election is gun control. What is your position on gun control?
I believe that every American citizen, as well as citizens around the globe, are entitled to gun ownership. It's a very sensitive topic to some, especially in some of the inner cities where there's lots of violent crime that involve guns. But I don't think that we should be blaming guns for that. I think that we should look at the social conditions overall that are leading to those crimes, and that stems back to capitalism. If you look at some of the things that are happening today as far as robberies and break-ins and armed robberies go, lots of people are stealing things because they need money for food, simply to feed their family or to pay their rent or to keep the lights on. Something as simple as that, so they resort to crime, and that's really a symptom of poverty, which is a symptom of capitalism. So in order to reduce crime, we don't need to ban guns, because there's other weapons besides guns. You could easily walk in somewhere with a knife and stab someone to death. So we don't need to focus on that. What we need to focus on is improving the social conditions of a society as a whole and the way that we think, and that starts by ending poverty. You know, the street gangs and such, where you were from out in Los Angeles, you have told stories about seeing the dead bodies in the streets and such. Well, that's all a result of the poor social conditions and the living standards, and that's what needs to be fixed. But it has nothing to do with guns.
Because myself, what I believe is if you take care of many of those symptoms, hunger, sickness, take care of the needs of people, they don't have any need as far as trying to secure any weapons for any type of violence. And, of course, I believe that people should have the right to bear arms. The types of weapons, should a person be able to have ownership of any type of weapon in their home?
Well, this is where it sort of gets tricky, because you might say something like, well, you know, we're going to give guns to 10 million people and
people
not one of them.
People ask me this question, and I want to hear your position.
Well, it's an interesting question, because you can argue, well, we'll give guns to 10 million people and not one of them could possibly have something wrong with them, you know, like some kind of mental illness or something. So obviously I think to a certain extent we need background checks and things such as that, and it could be something that's regulated. But as I said before...
Now, when you say regulated, explain what is your position, what is your ideas when you say regulated?
Well, I mean, there should be, I think, some common sense rules about it. I mean, you can't own a bazooka. I don't think anyone really needs that. I would say just basic handguns and such to own in their home, or rifles for hunting or anything they need. So I don't think gun rights should be curbed to that extent. But I do think the background checks are probably a good idea.
Some of the weapons that we have today, the founding fathers, they had no clue as to that these weapons would be available to human beings. I mean, you have some weapons now where you can take out an entire neighborhood. So, Ruth Ann, are you still there?
Oh, yeah.
Ruth Ann, I want to hear your position on this, because I've discussed this with you from time to time, and it's very interesting.
Yeah, I don't like regulations. I mean, as far as what kind of guns you can have, I agree with you guys. little bit of background check kind of thing. It's okay. Obviously, you shouldn't sell maybe to 13-year-olds. Okay. But if you just try to keep a certain kind of gun that is okay for your homeowners, residents, whatever, to have, the quote-unquote bad guys are going to have the more powerful guns always. So I can't see how you're going to enforce that and say, well, you can only have a pistol in your home when the gangs have the bazookas, okay? I just don't know how you would do that unless you start registering guns or continue registering guns, which I think is a very bad thing. I don't know all the answers, but I do know some of the things that I think don't work.
And part of what Justin had mentioned, I think, you know, having somewhat of a background check to make certain the person doesn't have any mental illness, because he needs to be treat the person needs to be treated for the mental illness, rather than giving them permits so that they can possess.
Would that go with politicians too? We know they're mentally ill. Do they?
How about politicians?
It would apply to
politicians.
Politicians
can't own guns. Is that okay?
Yeah, I like that. Okay, yeah, we're getting somewhere now. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry, Stuart, you can't have the gun.
And also, I think if a person has had a history of violence, I think that, you know, we need to think out regulations like that before we just issue anyone a weapon. I don't necessarily think that people need to go and register firearms with the state. I don't think many of these regulations that are required today, I think they're very extensive and various waiting periods. But as Justin had mentioned, I believe in certain situations, if they've had some background of violence or mental illness, I think that should apply.
Well, this is an issue I don't think that's really just black or white. I mean, there's some really reactionary and extreme positions on both sides. You got one side that'll say, ban all guns now, and obviously that's not going to work for anything because,
right.
No, it's not.
You know, if you outlaw guns, only outlaws will have guns.
Exactly.
So that's not going to work. But then there's the other extreme that says, yes, I have the right to have a rocket-propelled grenade launcher in my front yard. Well, why do you need that? Well, I don't have to explain that to you. Well, yeah, we need a little bit of an explanation here.
Because the gang down the street has one.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a... Right. Well,
I think there should be certain limitations on that.
But once again, when we talk about the gang thing, that goes back to what I'm talking about with the social conditions. We've got to work on that first before we even discuss guns or weapons or violence.
Right.
We got to look at what's causing it. And so maybe if that gang wasn't around, if those kids were actually getting an education and enjoying life and weren't poor, then this guy wouldn't need a rocket-propelled grenade launcher in his front yard.
Really?
Right.
But you're talking about I hate the word, but underprivileged or undereducated or whatever people, because, you know, they are not necessarily the only ones who commit crimes. Here in Illinois, and because it's very close to me, but I won't go into too much detail, recently somebody was let out. He had been sentenced to 8 years for some type of robbery. He was let out in a year. Within 48 hours, he had killed someone. He'd stabbed them to death and tried to kill another person. And, you know, if something's really wrong when you have someone serving 5 years because he was caught with a little bit of weed, but then yet you have somebody who's in jail or prison let out way, way early because he's a psychopath or sociopath, and he, fooled everybody, and then he commits murder and attempted murder. We have a lot of problems, and he was given, I mean, he had the education, he had the stuff. It was not lack of for him. So, you know, it's really a lot of the individual themselves.
Right. I agree with you. Justin, what I would like for you to do is just make one more. I would like to reintroduce Justin once again. He is our guest. He's with the Socialist Party USA, 19 years old. He's been very involved with the Alexander Mendoza campaign here for 2012. And he is our guest today. Justin, could you just take maybe another minute just to reintroduce yourself, and then we're going to conclude within the next few minutes for our program today.
Sure. I'll reintroduce myself again. My name is Justin Jones. I am actually a political activist from Alabama. I'm 19 years old. I became a member of the Socialist Party USA in December of 2011, and I am supporting the Alexander Mendoza campaign for 2012. I plan to go vote for Stuart Alexander tomorrow, and I strongly suggest anyone else to do so. If you don't want to vote for someone who will commit global war crimes as well as robbing the working class while enriching the capitalists. So if you don't want a corporate-owned candidate, I suggest you look for alternatives, and Stuart Alexander is one of the best out there. I became a political activist when I was 13 or 14 years old. I became more educated over time and actually discovered that I was a socialist. So there's plenty of great things out there on the Internet if you actually read some good websites and you see through the propaganda that's thrown out in the mainstream. It's a very liberating feeling.
Well, we appreciate you being on the show today. It's a couple other areas that I'm going to get into before we end our program today, Justin. And myself, I've been a very strong activist and also an advocate for protecting our environment. And you were right in that area where they had the BP oil spill there in the Gulf. And now we have this government is saying that it's clean and commercial sand is safe to come here in these areas for tourism.
They're taking vacations.
To me,
again,
it's
right?
A bunch of crap. But
yeah, it is.
What is going on in that area? I mean, that much oil, you don't get rid of it within a matter of a few months or even a few years. It's still there. Let me hear your thoughts on that.
No, of course it's still there. It impacted the local economies here like never before. And the saddest thing about it is BP got off pretty much scot-free. They didn't have any... No one, as far as I know, was prosecuted, even though this was clearly an economic terrorism, is what this was, basically. It ruined the livelihoods for many people, who, had, you know, their entire lives, all they've been is fishermen. Well, they've got some big problems now. All the fish are dead, so how are they going to make a living? There was no help for those people. There was nothing. You know, things such as that, it's not just the oil spill either. It's all kind of environmental factors that have gotten worse over the years. There's this big thing now about fracking that I'm sure we've all familiar with.
Right.
Up in places like Pennsylvania and such where people have had their turn on the water and it catches fire. You know, this is getting into the water supply. This is very dangerous, and this is all in the name for profit. And it's not a good thing for our environment. Capitalism is it? Not at all.
And when we look at this, the BP oil spill, once again, the damage that it has created on the entire ecosystem there as far as in the wetlands there with the coastal regions, and also you mentioned about the fishing and also the livelihood of many of the people that had to depend on that. And as I mentioned, the problem is still there. The other problem that we see that is making its way down to that coastal area is Keystone XL. What is your ideas on that? And just share a little bit about that.
Well, I believe Ruth Ann had someone on her show. It was on Progress Towards Democracy. Someone in Texas who
right,
would
Julia
be affected.
Trick Crawford. Mm-hmm.
Yes, who would be affected by the Keystone XL pipeline. They were actually going to run the pipeline through some of her property. You know, and this is the interesting thing about it. The whole idea behind capitalism is, or one of the biggest ideas, is the ownership of private property. But until the capitalists decide that you can't own it anymore, that they want it, right? And so that's basically what's going on. It's an issue of class warfare. It's all in the name of profit. It's not good for the environment. It's not good for the people. It's not going to be good for the economy, not for working people anyway, because the conditions that they're living in are still going to be atrocious. This is going to do nothing but enrich people like the Koch brothers.
Now, that project, they're saying that it's going to be able to create all these thousands of jobs. Myself, I'm looking at the longer-term impact that it's going to create, and I think it's going to create more damage where it will be jobs that need to be created to take care of the damage. But we see under capitalism, they create the damage and then they leave the waste there for future generations. That's what I see.
Well, the problem is with the whole thing about jobs. Well, sure, it would create jobs, but that's the problem with the capitalist economy. The need for jobs isn't based around needs of people. It's based around profit.
Right.
For example, if we had an economy based on need, right now out there in New Jersey and New York, there's millions of people who are still without power, that are cold, they're hungry. We could hire about 100,000 unemployed people right now to go up there and work on disaster relief. That would create jobs. That's something that people need.
Right.
That's the difference between an economy that works for need, not profit. Now, obviously, our government's not going to do something like that. They're not going to hire people to help people that are in need. They would only do that if someone could make a profit off of it.
Justin, just in the last few minutes that we have here, what are some of the things that you see, the work that you see for yourself over the next 2, 3, 4 years, party building, and also as you get more involved in the political process? Right now you're 19 years old. When I speak with you, it's just like speaking with someone that's been involved in politics for the last 20 or 30 years, which I can appreciate that. But where do you see yourself involved, your involvement over the next 2 to 3 years there locally, also in the party? Just share that with us.
Well, actually, I want to turn my attention after the election to building the party locally. I think that's the best shot we've got because, obviously, on the national level, they're not going to make the corporate elite. They're not going to let us make much headway because they won't even allow someone like you into the debates or to get any press coverage or at least very little. I mean, you did get on Stossel's show once, but that was pretty much it.
Right.
So we need to start working on things like locally. For example, if we could build here in Alabama right now, I don't even think we have a Socialist Party USA headquarters in the state yet. So that's obviously something I want to turn my attention to. We have a lot of people who support the Socialist Party USA and the Alexander Mendoza campaign here in Alabama because there's a very large Facebook following for it for people who are just in Alabama. So if we could work on things like that, building the party, and as well as on a local level, we could get people running for office for things like Board of Education, just very simple things, to sort of build the foundation and build the base of the party so people can understand what we're all about. And so I think that's what I want to turn my attention more to, but obviously I'll be involved in national politics as well, with my commentary on it at least.
Do you have a Facebook page there for the party there, or a Facebook page where people can be in touch with you or reach you there in Alabama?
It's a Facebook group, and it's called the Socialist Party USA Alabama, and it's supposed to be like the Alabama branch, but just on social media because we don't have an official party headquarters. Now, last year, this was shortly before I joined the party. I think they held a couple of meetings in Birmingham, and it was maybe 4 or 5 people, and I told them I couldn't show up because I wasn't going to drive 2 hours for something that 4 people were going to show up for. I can't afford it.
Right.
Yeah, there's Facebook pages out there. I mean, the page has grown, too. I've turned lots of people on to the ideas of the Socialist Party USA. My dad, for instance, who was going to write your name in tomorrow. That's one of them. So it's just one at a time. It's just social media as well as talking to people just locally and in your community really helps, and that's what I want to turn my focus on to.
Well, Justin, again, I'd like to extend my appreciation for you coming and joining us on the program. I look forward to having you to join us in the future. You have been an excellent guest for this evening. And I just want to let people know once again how they can reach the Alexander Mendoza campaign. You can go to our website, which is Stuart Alexander for President 2012. And I encourage everyone to go to the polls tomorrow. Remember, you can write in Stuart Alexander and also Stuart Alexander for President, Alex Mendoza for Vice President. Your vote is important. You have to be able to voice your opinion that you are not satisfied with a two-party system that is not working for working people. Also, I would ask people to join us in the post-election, in our post-election programs that we'll be having over the next 2 weeks, and we'll be having other guests. So just be certain to tune in and listen to our program over the next 2 to 3 weeks, where we will be having people where you can call in and share your viewpoints. Once again, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you in the very near future. Have a good night.
You too. You're welcome, and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you. Thank you.
In the beginning of September, you'll find DaughtersDevices.com. Fully functional, I'm waiting for you to go on over and make your purchases of any of our oils or our flower essence formulas or misters or powders, potions, and brews, because we've even got teas. That's the ancestor of aromacology over at DaughtersVices.com. Thank you now for coming by to see us. We appreciate it.
And tonight, Vinny, it's all yours.
Hello, Ruth Ann, distinguished guest, or is it distinguished guest?
or extinguished?
extinguished. No, we're still breathing.
Yep, we're not extinguished.
And our show is called Liahona Times. And that's the word compass goes along with the word Liahona. The Liahona is an ancient word for compass that fell out of use probably over 2,000 years ago. But it was dredged up along with the gold plates that became what we call the Book of Mormon. And my role is that of an LDS observer. The political activities of a nation run amok. Now, you had some questions for me.
Right.
You talked about.
Yeah. I wanted to just ask you a few questions because I know a lot of people have definitely the wrong idea of Mormons, of people of the Church of Latter-day Saints. And I just wanted to have you clear up a few things. You've already mentioned the tablets. Would you talk a little bit about Joseph Smith, who was founder, I believe, and the tablets that he found back in the 1800s?
Okay. Joseph was part of a family of New England farmers that had moved to upstate New York in the around 1812, and they'd had a few years where they almost lost the farm. They, weren't very successful at farming. His dad had a business that he ran, that he tended to give stuff away to poor people. So he wasn't a very good capitalist in that sense. And so as Joseph was growing up, there was in that region, the whole region, that got really worked up about, you know, what they call a spiritual revival, and all the churches were caught up in it, all of the Christian churches, and he wondered which one was right. He couldn't discern, you know, he was, 13, 14 years of age. He couldn't, you know, tell right away which one had the correct interpretation of the Bible. And so,
right, well, that would be a logical thing. But why don't you just fast forward a little bit to when he was a man?
Okay.
And when he found these tablets, because Mormonism, as I understand it, I could be wrong, is based a lot on these tablets. Is that correct?
Well, the tablets, he was shown in a vision, an angel appeared to him that said that he was one of the ancient prophets here in the, you know, on this continent, that was one of the keepers of this ancient record.
Now, he was not well educated, was he?
He'd had 3 years of formal schooling, mm-hmm. and had basically been taught at home, and that was fairly common on the frontier at that time.
Right. How old was he when he found these tablets?
He was about 18, or 17, going on 18.
Ah, okay. I thought he was older, so he was basically a kid still.
Right, but he was told where to find them, but he was warned not to seek monetary gain, not even entertain the thought that these could be sold or, sell, one sheet out of, a thick book of gold, beaten gold. So he went to the place where the tablets were, which he was also shown in a vision, where to go. And when he got there, he started taking things out of the box, and the angel, came to him and told him that he had to wait. And it turned out it was 4 more years that he was supposed to come there every year. And so he was he was around 23 years old when he finally took the plates from their hiding place. And it was 2 more years before he was able to work exclusively on the translation. So he was able to read pretty well, but he couldn't translate, interpret and write stuff down at the same time.
The tablets are no longer in existence. Is this true?
No, they were returned to the angel. And there's kind of a fascinating story that the place where he took them back to, inside of the mountain, had large stone tables filled with records of the same sort that that he was holding.
So they weren't unique in that sense.
Well, they're unique in the sense that they haven't found the other cave, which debate is whether it's in New York or whether it's in Mexico, Guatemala, in that area, anyway, that's a different discussion.
Right. Well, actually, I wanted to touch on that because I just wanted to, there's a few things. The people have heard a little of this and a little of that. And one thing, do you want to just give a little bit of the background of the affinity for Native Americans?
Okay. Well, the records are recognized as part of an ancient library you know, not so much because of what was translated in English, but because in different parts of the world, such as Persia, they have found, records, engraved on thin metal tablets, mostly like bronze. There was even a copper scroll in among the Dead Sea Scrolls. The only thing that's unusual about it was that, you know, it came out 100 years before any of these other ancient libraries were found. But to date, as far as I heard, it's been a few years, that there's close to 660,000 scrolls that they found all over Asia and in Eastern Europe and Africa, North Africa.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot. When people think about Mormons, sometimes they jokingly start in on the wives thing.
Right.
Could you just, I know you've heard it and heard it and heard it.
Sure.
But talk a bit about...
It doesn't bother me,
Well, and, you know, we were told that Utah gave this up, the settlers there, so that they could become a state in the United States. And that was one of the requirements. And then we've all seen articles or news bits and pieces here and there that some people who supposedly are not recognized by the official church still practice polygamy.
Right.
Do you want to just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The other thing that they gave up in 1890 was the women's right to vote, which, you know, didn't come to the rest of the nation until 1920.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that the women not only were encouraged to vote and you know, could vote against the wishes of their husbands, or the church executives. There was never any, there wasn't really any benefit to the women to become the state of Utah. You know, if they had to give up the right to vote, had the government taken away property from the Mormons because of plural marriage, it had become more of a liability, even for the church. They were stripped of their property.
Oh, okay. So they were actually, the government actually took property from people because of plural marriage?
Yeah, well, they took all of the church's public buildings were being taken away under Edmunds Tucker, which was, you know, around 1887. So during the, you know, most of the 1880s, the president of the church, was in hiding. Families were driven into Mexico to escape persecution, and then they remained in Mexico, and Romney's family was part of that exodus to Mexico.
Yeah, I knew that people did go to Mexico. In that, some of the writings, I believe that there is mentions of the Native Americans.
Right.
And what does that, you know, because that's the only, aside from Native stories, holy scriptures, whatever you want to call them, that actually talk about that. I mean, the Quran doesn't, as far as I know. I've never read it anyway. The Bible doesn't. So I think that's sort of unique. Would you just explain the what stance and where Native Americans fit in?
Well, the first group that came, you know, according to the Book of Mormon record, were known as the Jaredites, and scholars today associate them with the Olmecs. that started showing up around 2,200 years before the birth of Jesus.
Mm.
The next group came around 600 years before the birth of Christ, and they were Ishmaelite and also the tribe of Joseph and the tribe of Judah. So there was several groups of families that they came here, and it points out that some of them had records, brought records with them from Jerusalem and Palestine, and the other ones.
So how did they get here?
They built their own ships. They built boats.
Okay.
And it actually talks about shipbuilding. Became extensive about 50 years before the birth of Christ. There was
And you're saying that, like, we were told in school that North America was populated by Indians who came across the Aleutian chain of islands. Now, Mormons don't believe that. They believe that they're the offspring of people who came from Palestine thousands of years ago.
Well, no, that's been one of the debates, even among Mormons scholars.
Okay.
Is where these groups came from. That John Sorensen, who was the dean of anthropology, wrote a book on ancient American settings for the Book of Mormon that I read when I was right out of high school, I think. And it still holds true today that if you have a group that is essentially following the law of Moses, then anyone around them that didn't follow the law of Moses is considered to be, Gentile, pagan, fill in the blank, idol worship.
Right.
Okay, so essentially everybody around them, which was, considered to be, the enemy, eventually, around the 5th century, after the coming of Christ, around, 450 A.D., the last of the quote unquote fair skin, the group that come from Palestine, the Israelite group, are completely overrun and they become extinct. They become massacred by their enemies.
Well,
and so go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, so the enemy, so when Mormons were settling the United States and moving west, Salt Lake, they probably killed their share of Native Americans. So that seems a little strange if these were people that they had some high regard for in the intellectual realm, anyway.
Well,
but now
there's two. Pieces of evidence that they didn't kill the natives.
That many?
Well, they actually went out of their way to avoid any type of bloodshed. They adopted a policy. In fact, it's attributed to Brigham Young. It's better to feed them than to fight them.
Mm.
So they essentially went out of their way to befriend the Indians. And one of our noted, became known as the apostle to, they called the natives, Lamanites, which is one of the names of the hostile, groups of the family that turned to
okay.
idolatry in, the opening chapters of the Book of Mormon. So, Laman being the brother of Nephi, so the good guys are the Nephites and the bad guys are the Lamanites.
Mm.
And about 500 years later, before the coming of Christ, they they kind of switch roles to where the Lamanites become the good guys and the Nephites become the bad guys. So,
because I know that there was some type of a Native American connection, but you're saying that some people say that this is like the tribes of Israel. What about then, up until, I don't know, I'm sure you know the date, blacks could not hold office, and then there was a revelation or something. How does that, I mean, I personally like the idea that the Mormon Church is still evolving, and because I know some religious groups that stopped hundreds of years ago, and that they don't
right.
want anything new, and you know, they think that something new brought in, like music or something, not that that's new, but you know, that's
right.
evil, and the Mormon Church, it keeps evolving, which is why it keeps growing, I think. The revelation is that like the Council of 12, or is that the president? Who has revelations that change things? So now we have black bishops.
Right.
Before, you know, even blacks weren't baptized till, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, maybe. It's been a whole switch. So who has the revelations?
Well, they come to the Council of the Twelve, along with the presidency, which is made up of you know, and they're also apostles, as we term apostles. The principal, if you go back to Joseph Smith, he was ordaining freed slaves. They made it a policy not to baptize, people who were still under, slave ownership.
Ah.
But they had a group of freed slaves, and some of them were ordained to the priesthood, and as far as we can tell, some of the 12 objected, and there's a principle in the church that's kept it together all for 150 some years, 180 years. That all decisions made by the Council of the Twelve have to be unanimous.
Consensual. You go by consensus. Yeah.
Yeah. So in other words,
people.
That consensus, when the group of brethren in 1978, after many years of getting letters from people in Africa saying, send, we want to start a church.
Yeah.
And so when we got to like Nigeria and Ghana, there were already about, I'm trying to think what the number was, like 1,500 churches that were organized, and by locals that had gone on on their own,
wow.
disorganized and according to the scriptures that had been mailed to them. And so the church was in the position, of sending their legal counsel to each one of those congregations and asking permission for, the official church, the Salt Lake City Church, to use the same name.
Mm.
So it was quite an interesting 2 years, and
So then that was how, it was just like people asking and asking. And I know the Council of 12 does a lot of praying about things. And recently they made a big announcement about, 5 weeks ago maybe?
Right.
Maybe, 4 or 5 weeks ago. Would you want to tell us a little bit about what that is? Because most people, a lot of people know that young Mormon men go on mission, and many of the young Mormon women do. But do you want to tell about this announcement? It was pretty exciting, and it's changed a lot of things already.
Oh yeah, we're still seeing the impact here, just in our area here in Western Kansas. The announcement was that, you know, for several decades, the age of young men, minimum age was 19, and the minimum age for young women, and it's been that way for at least 30 years, that was 21.
Mm-hmm.
The announcement was that young women can serve at 19, young men can now serve at 18. And it essentially allows, you know, because in some countries they still have forced conscription, in other words, you know, military service.
Right.
And so most of the countries have a, you know, deferment for full-time ministers. And so that, you know, it is a deferment. In other words, after their mission, they're still expected to serve, you know, their country. You know, it's not a, you know, get out of the military draft dodge.
Right.
As some have stated. But the significance of this is that young women who have been, you know, they graduated at 18 from high school, for example, you know, sometime between 17 and 18, and they have to wait 3 years while they're, you know, earning money, and chances are they're going to meet someone, and maybe they want to get married or finish college.
Yeah.
So by the time they're 21 years old, you know, then they kind of, you know, think, well, if I don't,
well, they've
married,
got another life. Yeah.
Right. They start a whole other life, and so by going out at 19, they can carry that enthusiasm, you know, and that experience. They bring it back, and then they can go and they can get on with their life instead of putting their life on hold until they're 21. So.
Well, and you know, this actually is affecting your own family already.
Yes.
So yeah, you have a daughter who's going to be going sooner than planned.
Yep, she'll be eligible in a year, and she's in college right now. I was going to mention that we got some statistics on that before the announcement. They're getting like 400 applications to serve, and or 700. And after the announcement, that jumped to 4,000 a week.
A week. Yes. I mean, that's amazing. That from 700 a week to over 4,000. So, what do you think is going to be the result of this?
Well, I think it's going to impact on young men because they're not going to have, you know, any girls,
girls are going to be left.
Mooning over them. The young women, they become very, you know, very focused on their goals. I see it with my own daughter. And they become very, goal-oriented and very successful at achieving their goals, you know, which they do. They start out small and then, you know, they continue to have success in that area. My daughter actually set, you know, the standards for the rest of the family to follow her example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That you have to be very proud that, because you had told me, and in fact I was watching when they made the announcement, and then we talked like later the next day, I think, and I think it was like the next day then you said, well, your daughter is, she's already told you. She called and told you. That's, yeah. Like, wow. Okay. They weren't wasting any time.
She texted on Facebook. She posted, you know, how excited she was. There's been some opportunity recently for my son to, he's working and saving money so that he can go. So the, I'll have two kids out at the same time.
Well, would you explain a couple things about this now? Like, they actually go to a place for training, and the family pays, like, thousands of dollars to help them. And maybe if the family can't do it all, the congregation tries to chip in. But, I mean, basically, you're responsible for a big chunk of money for each of your kids when they're off.
Right. And so that's part of the trial of faith, as it were, for each, you know, family to save a little over while the kids are growing up.
Right.
You know, and that's something I failed to do, is, you know, where every month you're sitting down with the kids and helping them budget, and you know, this goes for tithing, you know, and here's your mission fund. And so
right.
if you save 10%, you know, in one and 10% in the other, they still got 80% of their money to, you know, to go out and spend and you know, and whatever.
Yeah.
But once they start saving, they just forget. They just forget about it. They just, you know, put it away, and by the time they're old enough, and so that's why there were so many that applied right away, is because their families had been preparing, you know, for them to, you know, to go out and serve in the mission field
since they were born. I mean, if the people
yeah.
were of the faith when the kids came along, I mean, it was just an automatic thing. We're saving for the fund because they'll be going on a mission.
Right. Now, you had a question about the training facility.
Yeah, the training. So when they go off, now I guess well, it's up to you to train them some and their local church, but they actually go to a school for a couple months or so,
right?
Before they go on a mission?
Right. The English speaking would go for 3 weeks, and then that's been reduced by a third. So.
Wow.
I went Spanish speaking, so I was there for 8 weeks, and so now the Spanish speaking will go for 6 weeks, and I guess there are some missionaries that go for 9 weeks, and they'll, you know, and so their time will be reduced as well. So they basically go to any one of 18 facilities worldwide, I believe. It's around 18 facilities. Throughout, you know, South America and Asia and Mexico, and I don't know where they are in Europe, but it just making it easier for people to get to the training facility.
Well, now would that be like
your
daughter lives in this country, so she would go to a training facility here, and
right.
then be sent to another country.
Right. She, for example, she would probably go to Provo, Utah.
Right.
Which, you know, now they're trying to figure out what to do about housing, because they might have to take over some of the housing at Brigham Young University.
Mm-hmm.
This has had a cascade effect. Our mission here in western Nebraska is expected to get 50 more missionaries. And there have been open up about 30 new missions worldwide as a result of this announcement.
Wow. So this is big. This is the biggest one to come down the pipe for a while in the church,
I believe. I would say that this is as important for the progress of the whole, you know, the church and it, you know, in other words, its visibility. You know, the way that society, you know, sees our mission, you know, isn't to steal from other churches. There's a lot of people out there that don't feel welcome. They can come to our church, and it's not going to take anything away from the churches that they weren't attending across the street. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. No, that I lived in Idaho for quite a while. And lots of Mormons there. Well, you know, it's next door to Utah. But the Mormon people were very admirable. I had no problems. And I loved the way they seem to be very organized, obviously. And they take care of people. There's the, I can't think what it's called.
So the women have an organization, and they do a lot of good, but it just seems like the Mormons had something about them that a lot of other people didn't, and it was something very good. I've always been biased in favor of Mormons. So you think that the future now, because of all of these missions that are opening with all of these youngsters coming out, it's going to make a big difference. Like you said, we're going to hear a lot more. It's just getting exposure. So I guess I should stop asking questions because you have some other things you want to talk about tonight.
No, I enjoy the you know, you have good what I call a good type of questions. It shows that you respect the subject enough to learn about it.
I do.
And here's where because my friend and I were listening to the conversation with Stuart Alexander, and I didn't know who his guest was from Alabama.
Justin Jones. He's on. It used to be, well, his YouTube thing, I think, will still say Evil with EVEL, Evil Justin Jones. He's done a lot of videos for Stuart and other, political issues. But he's done a lot for Stuart. But yeah, he just turned 19. Actually, he and Stuart have the same birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so he's just started college. And he's one of those young people who's very aware of politics, which you don't find a lot of them.
Yeah, I would like to see, and this is one of the things, I think I told you about my encounter with a man from El Salvador that was in part of my missionary training in Provo before I went to Venezuela.
Yeah. Do you want to just briefly talk about that a little bit now?
Yeah, well, the impact that this young man had on me, he wasn't much older than we were, had very soft-spoken, but when he told us about what things were like in El Salvador, he had nothing good to say about capital, ism.
Yeah.
And we all thought that he was, definitely a commie. How to get into the church, did they know that he was a communist? that was kind of the way that we all felt.
Sure.
Hearing his story, his side of the story, well, this is what capitalism looks like. This is why the people don't have land, is because the best land goes to, the corporations. And so he just laid it out for us, very straightforward, and when I was in Venezuela, I got to see it, myself. I got to see how, all the wealth flowed into the oil companies, and the ground was, oozing oil in one of the areas I was in. It was coming up through the ground near the lake bed, Lake Maracaibo. And so by the time that I left, because I had my own insurance business. I was with Art Williams Company, A.L. Williams, when I was 20 years old.
Mm.
And so I started to, plan my financial empire, as it were, that I'd already started building, by recruiting people to my insurance business. And then my top producer went to Chile while I was in Venezuela. And I got back to it when I got, I got back in the insurance business when I got home, but not with the same enthusiasm. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, there's definitely something wrong, and it's not just, X, Y, and Z companies.
Right.
There's something wrong with the whole structure.
Right, the whole foundation. It's built on sand.
That's
wonderful that you got to see down there. I mean, while you're on a mission and you're teaching people and then you're learning other things too. Was that where you got your political feet?
Well, that was where I saw the persecution of the Native Americans that I was working with, the Colombian tribe, but they actually come from the Caribbean. They're descendants of the Caribe, and so my closest friends were being, you know, hunted down by the border guard, as it were, and robbed when they would bring stuff back into, you know, to sell at the flea markets. Well, the shopkeepers didn't like the Indians,
right?
You know, the indigenous people, you know, selling the same stuff on the streets that, you know, without the overhead.
But sure, I mean, the indigenous people needed to make, you know, they needed to feed themselves, but the shopkeepers, of course, wouldn't want that at the risk of them making a big profit. Yeah.
But I didn't associate it as much with the corporation. I didn't see the, you know, who was, you know, ordering the police, the whole Walmart structure behind the antagonism of the shopkeepers. I just saw it as more of a racial divide, you know, a cultural divide. And
was a racial cultural divide. Yeah.
But the scramble for, you know, for dollars or whatever type of fiat paper currency that is presented and then that becomes the coin of the realm, so to speak. You know, even though it's nothing other than, you know, monopoly paper, but the corporate government says that it has value. So as long as that government is in place, you know, then their money still works.
Yeah. Where? But now you had friends there when you were on your mission, and what was the most important thing that you yourself learned when you were gone on the mission?
That's something that I don't think anyone's asked me in a long time, but the most important thing that I learned while I was there was to not give up. My success came the last week of my mission as far as baptisms. I didn't really pursue them. You know, I knew that people would be baptized when they were ready. But I never, you know, went after baptisms trying to, you know,
trying to chalk up a number. Yeah, a quota.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's not always the case, but, you know, you hope, and working with the missionaries that are serving out here, you know, if I can instill anything in them, it's, you know, wait till people are hungry, you know, or they want what it is that you have. Wait until they're ready, and then they, you know, they'll grab hold of it and take ownership.
Mm.
You know, it becomes theirs. It, you know, in other words, it's the word, you know, mission. And I know that a lot of people associated with Palestine don't like the word Zion, but the word itself has been corrupted from its ancient meaning, was a pure people, you know, a holy people in a holy place.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you take the word mission, you break it down into Spanish, it comes back as my Zion, you know, mine. You take ownership of that mission,
right,
as being, you know, your own personal, quest, vision quest, as it were. And you get people, you know, they're saying that you give people salt, you know, and then you give them water, you know, that will quench their thirst.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people aren't thirsty, you know, it's because, you know, they don't like what you're peddling. You know, there's something wrong with what, you know, in other words, don't try to sell it, don't try to push it.
Right.
You know, just
make it available.
Exactly.
That whole Buddhist thing about non-attachment, like,
yeah,
you put it there, and what people do with it, you try to let go of the attachment to it. But it sounds to me like, as far as on a spiritual level, missionaries, at least like you gained as much as you gave just by the lessons you learned. It seems like, because, well, I know when I watched that a few weeks ago, when they were making an announcement, and there were a couple men talked about their experiences as missionaries. And now these are men in their 60s or so, and the memories they had, and two of them had actually met. They were working together, and they remained friends this whole time. But they got all misty talking about it. I mean, it was such a powerful thing for them, and
I have yet to reconnect with the people in Venezuela, but I know that I literally have hundreds of people that my last area, they were teaching a lady. She was a widow with five boys, and she and three of her sons that were, you know, of the right age. The youngest one was too young to be baptized. They have to be 8 years old. And the older one was out of the house. But of the three boys, two of them went on full-time missions to Caracas. Each of them baptized over 200 people, of their own people.
Yeah.
So, I baptized basically one family the last week of my mission.
Right.
I consider it the... What's that?
Tell me, does the church or the missions in the countries, do they, like you said you weren't worried about the quote-unquote quota, but do they try to push that ever? So many people... Yeah, do they want you to get so many people per month or something in or baptized, or how does that work?
Well, they essentially use baptisms as a measure of success. In other words, if you're not baptizing, it's because you're not, you know, following the rules, you know, quote unquote. A lot of the mission leaders, you know, because they serve for 3 years, husband and wife. A lot of mission leaders are successful businessmen. They come out of the business world, and so they're used to goal, you know, quotas and captured numbers. But
right.
Ironically, you know, this is the part that gets me, Ruth Ann. I'm having to, you know, essentially challenge the local leaders to put in a table that has, you know, like pamphlets and magazines or a Book of Mormon in the entry of each of the buildings. You know, it's like, the, you know, I guess they expect that if someone's interested, then they're going to go up and ask the missionary to teach them. And you know, and part of my crusade, as it were, is, as you said, is to make it available, you know, not just to people off the street, but to our young people who might have, you know, somebody in mind, and so they pick up a book or a pamphlet to take to a friend.
Right. Yeah, I'm real big on handouts myself for almost anything. So I totally understand. Yeah, there needs to be the table where people don't have to talk to anybody, ask any questions if they don't want, but go pick up some literature.
I think it actually has more of an impact on the younger people if they don't have to ask an adult, you know, for permission to go get a book off the table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're basically starving our own young people, you know, that's going to change. I think that, you know, I mean, we just had a, you know, Western Nebraska, you know, conference that was up here, and everything is now focused, you know, at the regional level, on preparing our young people for full-time missions.
Right.
So as long as they were saying, well, the young men, it's their duty, and they're still saying that, you know, it's their duty, you know, do your duty. I mean, they kind of put it in kind of a military terms. But the old guard, as it were, served in World War II. I mean, you know, some of them, they went through World War II. You know, one of them is from Germany.
Yeah.
So it's remarkable that there's, you know, a German apostle. Well, there's still people that, you know, that were trained back in the day to fight Germans and Japanese.
Wow. You know, that's what I should ask you. What country, because you're in so many countries, what country has maybe the highest percentage of Mormons? I know I'll probably be surprised, because I was amazed to find out how many Muslims there are in Indonesia. That is like the Muslim capital of the world.
Right.
So is there something similar that's going to surprise me as far as like percentage-wise of Mormons? Even though the religion was founded here, that
but it's not as high. I think in Indonesia it's like 90%, right? Something like that.
Something, yeah. I mean, it's.
Yeah, like 200 million Indonesians, and the numbers that we're looking at is more like 20% of the island of Tonga, or islands of Tonga. 20% is the highest concentration I know of.
Okay.
Outside of outside of Utah.
Right, Utah. And like you told me recently that something we were some of us were surprised, and you said, well, it's no surprise that the a big paper in Salt Lake City had came out in support of Obama, and you told me, well, a lot of businesses in Utah aren't necessarily Mormon, and that this particular paper really isn't, and they've had some issues with the Mormon church before. So
yeah,
you weren't surprised.
Magnetic, since the 1870s or 80s, whenever it was.
Wow.
The Salt Lake Tribune, I don't mind naming names, but,
yeah.
But I am hoping to make contact with their religion editor, who was at that press conference that we watched.
Right.
Because I thought that she had the right type of questions, because she was already thinking ahead as to the impact that these young women being gone. You know, BYU is going to, you know, empty out. Brigham Young University has three campuses, Hawaii, Idaho, and Utah.
Yeah.
And they're going to take a hit. They're going to take a major hit.
They're going to take a hit for their ball players. It's like, okay, yeah, that was sort of funny when she said that. And I thought, what? And it's like, well, of course, because all these young men are going to be elsewhere.
Well, in West Point, and there's a whole lot of other places, the Air Force Academy. I know a young man that was at the Air Force Academy for a year or two before he went on a mission to Houston. Then he came back and graduated second in his senior class. But they learn, like I say, you know, you're really essentially allowed to discipline yourself. You know, and sometimes you'll hear these stories about how, you know, one missionary didn't want to get out of bed, and I had a companion that was from Caracas that he had started his mission when he was 17 years old, you know, because they couldn't get any North Americans in at the time.
Yeah.
And his dad was the bishop, and so him and his brother, it's like, okay, we're going on a mission. You know, bye, Dad, Mom. 17, 18 years of age. And so it's going to be a challenge for the mission presence because 18-year-old boys are not nearly as mature as 19-year-old girls. And, it's going to go back on, you know, the parents getting their young people, you know, ready for that separation for, you know.
But I think it's just very exciting. And like I said, I mean, I love the fact that the church is evolving as opposed to just being stuck and stale.
It has to. For one thing, if we truly believe that Christ is returning, you know, is he going to want to clean up our environmental, you know,
disasters?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're supposed to be stewards. And I was thinking that, you know, we talk about capital and social, but either one of them doesn't really, you know, go to the heart of the problem, which is, you know, essentially that stewardship, leadership concept that Stephen R. Covey spoke about for his whole life. You know, that as stewards, you know, we have responsibility to learn, you know, from others, and also we have a responsibility to lead when it's our turn.
To learn and to teach it. So that makes sense. I wanted to say that for our website, you can go to www.mormon.org for more information. And Vinny is on Facebook. Apprentice, Alephtautaubinbeazel. Look on our page to get the complete spelling if you want. And he is interested in many things, and in weeks to come, he's going to be talking about them all. But we just wanted to get the foundation because Vinny is a Mormon, and he doesn't pull any punches, and I like that. So thank you very much, my friend, and we'll be back next time. Thanks. Bye-bye, Vinny.
Namaste.